May it please the court, honorable judges. This is my name is Danielle Beach Oswald, and I'm representing the petitioner Thomas Basungan. It's an asylum case based on a French asylee applicant who had been arrested three times in 1997, in 2002, and in 2004. In this case, the board and the IJ failed to make a substantial evidence or meet the substantial evidence standard. We'll address three issues briefly: whether the departure for 10 days to Nigeria should be counted as a major factor on adverse credibility, and in the Second Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, and the 11th Circuit have all been very clear about that, that voluntary departure, although it can be one factor and maybe a relevant factor that relates to subjective well-founded fear of future persecution, it does not negate any past persecution. Specifically, in this case, unlike the case of Nagaruriya by this court, the Ashcroft, it's not a situation where the person came here for 2 years and then returned for 2 months and faced no problem or persecution when they returned to their home country. In this particular case, he went for 10 days to Nigeria. We don't know if he went by plane, if he went by car, if he walked across. Nigeria is right next door, so there's no nothing in the record that relates to that. And certainly the most serious arrest, in which he was held for 8 days, beaten severely, harmed, and then went to the hospital, was the third arrest, which came after this departure to Nigeria. This case, we would also like to address the fact about the inconsistencies. These inconsistencies, in fact, are not present and are contrary to the record. My opponent cites that the Kwesi witness statements contradict that of the respondent, because the respondent did not know whether the applicant was still a member of SDF, and he had not seen him at a 2009 meeting with Chief Taku. But he did say he had seen him in 2007 and 2008 in the United States at meetings. He also did say in his statement that he was an eyewitness to that third arrest, that he was actually present when the applicant petitioner was arrested, and he saw him, and he was questioned in detail about this, and he stated repeatedly that he could see because Mr. Basungan was in front of the crowd, and he saw him being taken by the police. He also testified that he had participated in numerous SDF, which is the opposition party in Cameroon, and the country conditions show that this party is severely persecuted and continues to be severely persecuted in Cameroon. And he said he participated with him in Cameroon on numerous activities. He said that they, although they belonged to different local sections called wards, they belonged to the same division. And he also knew that he had had a leadership position to which he'd been elected as secretary in charge of organization. What also failed to be considered is that there were numerous photographs in the record showing the respondent participating in demonstrations here in the United States, with some of which were with Chief Taku. More importantly, what it totally fails to consider is the fact that both the witness and the applicant testified that there was at that time some fractions and divisions in the party itself, so that some people questioned where the meeting should be held, who was the actual leader, and the petitioner himself said that he no longer considered Chief Taku to be part of the leadership of SDF.
Now, what difference does it make if he's no longer part of the leadership?
I think you're correct, as Judge Traxler.
Relevance as a witness, importance as a witness.
It does not make any difference in light of the fact that he had already submitted a letter, a detailed letter, on his behalf.
Well, I was referring really to the reason given for why he wasn't called as a witness, which the IJ attached significance to.
And she did attach a lot of significance to that, Your Honor. And I think part of the reason is, and this is not in the record, unfortunately, but there was a lot of problems at that time that Chief Taku was charging people too much to come and testify, and things like that were happening. He said he had personal issues. He didn't say specifically what those personal issues were. But to go to the testimony of Chief Taku himself, the government made a big deal about the fact that he got the third arrest wrong, that the first two arrests mentioned in his affidavit were correct, 97 and the exact date, 2002 and the exact date, but the date in 2004, he said November 6, 2005, instead of 2004. And the judge felt that his testimony would have been corrective of that point. However, if we look at the affidavit on paragraph 9, it specifically says that other pro-democracy activists, including Thomas Bassongen, were arbitrarily arrested during peaceful protest demonstration on November 6, 2004. So clearly the specific in the affidavit overrules the general statement where he had clearly made a typo in putting 2005, but the exact correct month and the correct day. What's more important about his affidavit is it also gives sources of how he had this information, because he did not know him back in Cameroon. But he verifies sources in paragraph 5 and 6 of his affidavit, which he says he's checked with certain critical elements, such as the Human Rights Defense Group, and he checked on the past persecution, and he checked on the arrests. And he also confirms his position as a leader in the local level for the Akoke Idoe ward. The judge and BIA also made, and just one other point on Mr. Taku, this point was never really brought up, and he was never given an opportunity to even address the issue. As relates to the wife, the government criticizes this. My opponent says that the letter was not her usual signature. And they did ask him, do you recognize the signature? And he said, that's not the signature she uses when she signs for the bank. Well, we all know that we have, most of us have numerous different ways of signing, depending on what we're signing, where we're signing. We don't all have, perhaps judges do, but we don't all sign things the exact same way everywhere we sign things. He did say, it is the handwriting of my wife, and the content, I believe, are her words. And if we look at the content, she refers to things about their children. She talks about the fact that their daughter is not going to school because of their fears. She talks and gives him greetings from people they knew. She also speaks of many things that only his wife would clearly know. And much of what she says is corroborated by other affiants. It doesn't seem to therefore make sense that if the totality of the content is his wife's, whether the signature is different or not on several different letters that she wrote, the one specifically, I think there's two letters in the record, is different. Another point that is very supportive of not having inconsistencies in this case is the testimony of the attorney himself, Mr. Henry Kang Mu, which is at JA 364 and 724 to 725. Again, this is a case of not reading the document properly, because the government contends, or my opponent contends, that this, in fact, did not match his testimony. Because on the third arrest, he said that he did not walk out of that jail, but a commotion was created, and the attorney was there, and he saw the attorney, and then he escaped. They said that the attorney should have gone with him. The attorney said he went with him. But that's not what it says. It specifically says in the attorney's letter that on two occasions, in 2002 and 2004, he was instrumental in getting him released. And he was able to get him released, because he was acting on behalf of the political party, Social Democratic Front, SDF, and also of his family and his father. And there is an affidavit of his father that supports this, and other family members also. He says that in paragraph 7, he gives his foundation of who he is. He talks about his position as Commissioner of Human Rights to the Human Rights Defense Group. And in paragraph 11, he specifically says, on the 2004, Mr. Basangan escaped in my presence. And that as a result, he, the attorney, was falsely imprisoned for 3 hours in Yaoundé at that time before he could leave the police station. Well, clearly, they didn't stay there for 3 hours. So clearly that supports what the petitioner said, is that he was able to leave. And the counsel got stopped for 3 hours because his client had escaped. And it totally corroborates what was a perceived inconsistency. Another perceived inconsistency in this particular affidavit was that the fact that they said, well, he said he got him released on bail July 3, whereas Mr. Basangan testified that he was released on July 4. Well, this is not a real inconsistency. And I would posture that this is not a real inconsistency because he came there on July 3 to get him released, posted the bond. Most attorneys would not then stay there and wait until the client's actually released. So it's not inconsistent at all that he would be released, in fact, the next day. Another point brought out just briefly is about the SDF letter and the card. Well, the SDF letter is written by Mr. Joseph Sapi, and he actually writes two letters, one in February 2008, one in December 2008. And the December letter corrects some of the mistakes that he felt he made in the 2000 earlier letter. There appears to be confusion in the translation at several points. Counsel actually brings out that the translation is not correct and that there's misunderstanding throughout the transcript. And the letter, the card itself and the letter seem to be confused in the mind of the petitioner. He's talking about the letter, and the court's talking about the card. In the card, it says that he was a member since 1997, and he joined in 2003, so there's no inconsistency. And in the letter, the error that it said 3 days for the 97, that was corrected. It was said 5 days. It was corrected to the 3 days, which was correct. And also it was brought out that the letter was on slightly different letterhead. But if you look at SDF letterheads, there's many different letterheads. They don't have one standard letterhead. And the other point I wanted to, that was as all I have to say about the inconsistencies. The other point I wanted to say is this totally disregard here of the independent evidence of past persecution. The judge basically did not follow Marianneke, Kamara, Karomo, or Zhu. She totally disregarded due to lack of foundation. There's about 16 documents that specifically support this case, one of which Dr. Koger's testimony, which she deemed totally credible. And Dr. Koger discussed the PTSD. Now, the First Circuit has actually two cases which talk about past persecution even being able to rest on a showing of psychological harm, providing the PTSD can establish that past persecution was provided, providing that the asylum applicant knows the diagnosis is related to the persecution directed at the applicant. Again, Mr. Sapi's testimony in many aspects corroborates. Mr. Kuis's testimony in many aspects corroborates. The medical was apparently submitted at the asylum office, and the attorney had apparently never submitted it to the judge, although it was a part of the record. It doesn't appear to have been translated, but it does support his injuries. He also has other personal eyewitnesses from SDF, Mr. Blaise Michelle, who says he was actually there and saw the arrest. I see my time's run up. Would the court give me any time to finish? Or
if you want to take it out of your reply time.
Okay. I also wanted to address Mr. Camden. Cam McGinney, he was also in the same ward of Estia. The neighbor, Gwendolyn Mibik-Undo, she was a neighbor and knew of his activities in the SDF. The uncle, he didn't testify in detail about the arrest. However, he did testify about his activities in SDF. The country documents that clearly show that the government cannot meet its burden to show that they have changed. And one point that the government clearly makes also is the fact that in his first footnote, he says, the record compels the conclusion that if the petitioner was credible, the court must remand to the board so that the immigration could determine in the first instance whether the petitioner qualified for asylum absent an adverse credibility determination. Nonetheless, even if there is an adverse credibility, the independent evidence should have been considered. We therefore ask that this petition for review be granted and that the BIA vacate and remand to the BIA for a decision.
All right, Mr.
Thank
Marquez,
you, Your Honors.
Markle.
Good morning, Your Honors. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Justin Markell, and I represent the Attorney General in this case. In this post-Real ID Act immigration case, the only question before this court is whether the record compels the conclusion that petitioner is credible. It is not enough for this court to determine that a reasonable fact finder could have found petitioner credible. Before the court can overturn the agency's decision, it must find that there's not a single reasonable fact finder that could have agreed with the agency. In this case, the board relied on five adverse factors in finding that petitioner was not credible. These adverse factors.
Mr. Markle, what is a judge to do if she is convinced that three out of the five factors the board relied on are not adequately explained, not cogently explained? How does that work?
Well,
for example, this business about the date.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think any reasonable person would agree that was a typo. And so, if that doesn't go into the calculus, then how can it be said that the board acted properly? Because it was very important to the board and to the IJ.
Your Honor, I think it does go to the calculus. I mean, in that all adverse credibility determinations are all looked at under the totality of the circumstances.
Right.
So we're looking at everything. In the vacuum, you might be right. A simple translation error or a typo would not be enough for an adverse credibility determination, but in a cumulative.
Well, but is a typo ever supportive of an adverse credibility determination? That's my problem.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree in that there is no reasonable fact finder that could possibly find that this undermined his credibility.
I'm sorry, could you say that one more time?
I respectfully disagree that there's no reasonable fact finder that could possibly find that the fact that this date was incorrect undermined petitioner's testimony in some way. I think it's reasonable to think it's a typo, and it's more likely than not it probably is a typo. But
wait, more likely than not? So you agree that by a preponderance, it's a typo? So how can a typo... How can a typo undermine anybody's credibility?
If you're agreeing that by
preponderance, it's a typo, how can that undermine credibility?
I think when you look at the totality of the circumstances, you look at who's the burden on. The burden is on the alien to provide.
But try to answer my question. How can a typo undermine credibility?
Okay, so it might not directly undermine credibility, but
forget
the way.
Forget directly and indirectly. How can a typo undermine credibility? A typo, by definition, is an unintentional and here clearly immaterial error
that has no probative weight on credibility. It's a typo.
Your Honor, for the sake of argument, I would agree with you and say, sure, it does not undermine credibility, but it does not support his burden of proof also, and that's part of this.
So that's why I asked my original question. So if the board and the IJ have relied, I would submit, very heavily in their credibility determination on a factor that you now agree by a preponderance clearly is a typo, clearly has no probative value with respect to credibility, where does that leave us?
Looking at the totality of the circumstances, Your Honor. And when you do that, you see there are multiple reasons in which the court could have relied upon in finding the petitioner not credible. I just came
so
back.
So how do I know that the board would evaluate and weigh all the other evidence the same way if, as a matter of law, a court says to the board and the IJ, and we all make mistakes. We all make mistakes.
Yes, Your Honor.
IJ, board, you made a very serious mistake here. You made a very serious mistake when you treated a typo as a weighty consideration on credibility. So isn't the most sensible thing to do under these circumstances to send it back to board to say, okay, everybody makes mistakes. We're not sure how to evaluate this mistake that you made. The counsel agrees was a mistake. By a preponderance, it's a typo. Take another look at this and see what you think.
Your Honor, I strongly disagree with the suggestion that the board heavily relied on that one adverse factor. Also, in particular, and related to that, his explanation for not calling Chief Takyo was implausible, as the court discussed.
But he wasn't asked, why didn't you call Chief Takyo to explain this typo? That's not what he was asked.
No, Your Honor. He was asked why he didn't call Chief Takyo, because apparently he was a strong enough witness that petitioner thought and told the court originally that he was going to bring him to court. He was the only person that has any leadership role within SDF. And notably, I mean, published, there's evidence that this guy really is a leader in the community. There's published in his, I think it's in his statement, he states that he regularly attends and testifies in people's cases for this very purpose. So when petitioner explains why he didn't call him and his explanation makes no sense, that in conjunction with the typo undermines his credibility.
You see, you just said it again. That in conjunction with the null set. The typo is a null set with respect to credibility. You just agreed with me on that.
Your Honor, I said for the sake of argument, I would agree with you. I don't actually agree with you.
Zero plus zero is zero.
I think it
even
is.
Even under immigration law.
Well, Your Honor, I would like to also point out that there's numerous other inconsistencies, and courts have routinely upheld decisions based on just one of the adverse factors that the agencies relied upon. In particular, I was in a case just a couple weeks ago in the Ninth Circuit where the only adverse factor that the court relied upon was the fact that he testified once saying that there was 22 people in prison, and then at the time he said there was 12 people in prison with him. And that was it. And that was enough for that court. Now, in this case,
let me ask you, does the petitioner have subpoena power? I'm not completely familiar with it.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, but I can't say I'm very familiar with it either. I would be surprised if he did.
Okay.
I just think the strongest inconsistency in this case that the board relied upon deals with his explanation of his wife's signatures. I think this is stunning for a number of reasons. First of all, as the immigration judge points out, he willingly submitted documents that he admitted that he didn't know who signed those documents. And then only later he testified that, oh yes, I did. I forget what I said earlier when I said I didn't know who signed these documents. I did. I asked my wife about them. My wife told me she signed these documents. And she says she didn't sign these documents because she didn't want to suffer any repercussions for signing the documents. An explanation on its own that does not make complete sense because her name was clearly printed on the documents and referenced to herself as being petitioner's wife. Now, there's also Mr. Kisu's testimony. He brings in one witness to testify about his participation in SDF. And this one witness's testimony contradicts his own testimony. Mr. Kisu says, I don't even know if petitioner's an active member in SDF. And I don't believe he is. Mr. Kisu then testified that I was at the November meeting. And petitioner was not at that meeting. There's also
so the IJ believed part and disbelieved part.
Well,
the IJ is entitled to, but there seems to me there ought to be some better explanation of why Kisu's testimony can be picked apart in that way, in light of the typo.
I think it goes to just submitting evidence that doesn't make sense. When you have evidence that's coming in that says one thing and it says another thing, supports some things and contradicts other things, it lends one's a reasonable fact finder to believe that the story coming from this person is not completely accurate. And when we look at the ID card that my opposing counsel mentioned, the ID card itself doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And when we look at he gets this letter from a Mr. Tappy that explains that the ID card, the reason why he didn't have an ID card issued in January when he joined SDF was because they were out of cards at that time. So they waited until June 24th, the day he got out of prison, to issue him a card. Now, that doesn't really explain what's going on with the ID card he actually submitted. Because the ID card he submitted on it has a date that says that the ID card looks like it was published in 2004.
You don't have to convince me, I can't speak for my colleagues, you don't have to convince me that on a proper record, an adverse decision here could have been made and sustained. But with the typo and what I regard as the wholly irrational conclusion that because he re-entered and then was beaten, arrested and beaten a third time, that somehow that re-entry totally undermines his credibility, it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I would.
It just doesn't make any sense.
I understand that, Your Honor. But the question is, does it make sense to any reasonable fact finder?
Well,
and I argue that there are reasonable fact finders.
The question is, if you take out the typo,
yes, Your Honor,
and you reject what I regard as the irrational inference that because he left for 10 days or something and came back and thereafter was arrested and severely beaten, that somehow he's not worthy of belief on those two bases. You see, as I started this colloquy with you, there may well be a basis here for the agency to say, we don't believe you. But it can't be irrational. It's got to be cogent explanation for why he's disbelieved. And when you rely on a typo and the irrationality of no reasonable person would ever return, and that somehow there's a difference between returning, being arrested, and beaten within inches of his life, on the one hand, it just doesn't make sense to me.
I would like to just point out one thing regarding his return. Petitioner really paints the immigration judge's decision as stating that it was implausible. And as you stated just a second ago, as that there was no reasonable person that would possibly come back. But that's not what the immigration judge said.
Well, the board used the term implausible.
In reference to that finding?
Yeah.
Well, If you look at the immigration judge's decision, you see that she explicitly just says that it undermines his credibility. I don't think the immigration
judge... That's even less than implausible.
Right.
That's just a border plate.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at. I don't think that the agency was saying that there's no possibility that someone would return. They were just saying that this is...
How does it undermine his credibility?
Anytime you return to a country where you said that just 6 months ago that you were unlawfully arrested and beaten for 5 days for no fault of your own, it suggests that your fear of that happening again is not as real as it might have.
And then you come back and you get arrested and beaten a third time. So there's no difference?
No, just it's more evidence. It would be even more ridiculous if he now returned back to Cameroon after the third arrest. Now, if he returned and got back and got beat a fifth time, that would be more evidence once again that
he's got to leave and come back, leave and come back, leave and come back, leave and eventually, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th time when he gets beaten, then he's got credibility?
No, all of that would undermine his credibility. Every time he re-enters the country after saying that he was persecuted in that country, his credibility is undermined by that action.
And that also goes to future persecution.
Right, Your Honor.
So he's not going to be beaten a fourth time if he goes back.
Well, the court doesn't believe that he was ever, the Justice Department doesn't believe he was ever beaten. They find him totally incredible. And that was the basis of this case.
I mean, wouldn't the fact, though, that wouldn't you say, okay, well, the fact he goes back, it's going to undermine his credibility. But since he was beaten, that sort of overcomes the fact that he went back. I mean, he's continually being beaten every time he goes there. Doesn't that up the credibility about the fear instead of, or do you just say that if he goes back to the country, he's automatically
no, so not you have to look at it in a linear fashion. He gets beaten twice, he leaves, he comes back. That suggests that those beatings did not scare him so much that he thought he'd be persecuted again in the future. He leaves, so once he gets back, he gets beaten the third time. Now he has this severe beating and he leaves and he says, now I'm really scared.
So you're going to send him back?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm a little bit surprised you're agreeing that this is a typo.
Your Honor, I said for the sake of argument, I actually do not believe that it's just a typo, and I explicitly stated that I think a reasonable fact finder could have disagreed with that.
You said more likely than not it was a typo.
Well,
that's what you said.
I misspoke, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Isn't it just as possible the whole thing's made up?
That is the government's position.
That's why there's a discrepancy. It's just not true.
Well, I think when you look at all the documents, you see there's very few documents that actually don't have any mistakes on them. The court notes that Mr. Taffy's documents that were supposed to explain his ID card that didn't make any sense. That the heading of those documents were different. They were switched around, like a mirror image of the original document. But they also lack the footer that's on every other SDF document that's in the record. So everywhere you turn, there seemed to be another reason why something didn't make sense. His story didn't jive in the ultimate, you know, conclusion of his case. Now, in conclusion, I'd just like to point out that in the Ninth Circuit in Jibril, the court talks about how after the Post-Real ID Act, it's only in the most extraordinary cases in which an adverse credibility determination by the agency would be overturned. This case does not provide extraordinary circumstances. And accordingly, the court should affirm the agency's decision and dismiss this petition for review.
I think we understand your argument. Let's hear from Ms. Beach Oswald in reply.
Thank you.
Your Honors, this case should never have been denied. In a current immigration court, this case would not be denied. Certainly, the last arrest, which was the most severe, that caused his escape, undermines anything about voluntary departure in this case. And the other circuits that I mentioned have clearly discussed that. The other thing, Your Honor, is if we were talking about documents written by people who were learned people, that would be different. We're talking about very simple people. This court has addressed that issue in Zhu and Marianenke, that documents from third world countries aren't going to be like documents from here. And we also have eyewitness accounts. Eyewitness accounts, even the witness himself, there's so much that he does support. And the fact that he saw the past persecution. There's two other witnesses that also knew of his activities and knew of what was going on. There's a lot of things in this record that do support what the respondent or petitioner in this case said. And the courts have clearly said, this court has said in Tawabi and Marianenke, that it's not going to support an adverse credibility finding that's based so clearly, as Judge Davis pointed out and Judge Cogburn pointed out, on speculation, conjecture, and otherwise unsupported personal opinion. The fact of whether it's a typo or not, I think, is very clear. It's been admitted by my opponent. But more than that, the specific that talks about Mr. Bessongen in the text itself says the correct date. So that specific is very clear there, that it is a typo. I thank Your Honors for your time.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel and then go into our last case.